As we age in America, more of us than ever before will suffer from chronic pain. Whether we receive appropriate treatment for that pain may be an open question, as many patients today continue to suffer from chronic pain, even as therapies are available for treatment. Hi, welcome to the Bioethics Channel, a production of the Center for Practical Bioethics. For more information about the center and its programs, visit practicalbioethics.org. That's practicalbioethics.org. Myra Christopher is president and CEO of the Center for Practical Bioethics, and she joins us now to talk about balancing pain policy. And Myra, you've often said that pain is fundamental to the covenant between the physician and the patient. And that's something to keep in mind as we talk about this topic, is it not?
Over the years that the center has worked directly on pain policy, in particular trying to balance pain policy, I think that I have come to know, not just from the many studies, but also from interaction with healthcare professionals, that often what frames their practice is concern about law, regulation, oversight, and so forth. There are many concerns that healthcare professionals will express with regard to treating pain, in particular if there are opiates necessary for that. And what we have tried to do is to reframe this issue and to help healthcare professionals think about this as their part of what called them to their work. And that is that even when you cannot heal, that you can always care. And the treatment of pain is certainly a direct expression of that from the patient's perspective.
But even with that, we have this imbalance these days where it seems like the treatment of pain lags behind the science. We have the ability to be able to treat certain kinds of pain, but there are barriers to having that happen.
Well, pain medicine as a subspecialty is a fairly new field, and we don't have the scientific foundation that we would like to have, and people are working diligently on that. The American Academy of Pain Medicine, the American Pain Society in particular, are spending a lot of effort trying to build that intellectual foundation. And I wish them the best of luck. We've done some research in this area and think it's important to do that. We'll continue to do so. But the experience of pain is very subjective. And, you know, as I've said to you, we could hit your hand with a hammer and my hand with a hammer with exactly the same amount of force, and our experiences might be very different from that. Our pain experiences, and not that one of us is stronger, one of us is weaker, one of us is smarter, any of that. It's just that it is different. So I think that there is this subjective element to the treatment of pain. And that, too, sort of brings me back to why I think it's so essential to talk about the covenant between the physician and the patient, because there has to be a level of communication, of honest exchange, and underpinned by trust, or we're never going to be successful in treating pain, no matter where we are with regard to the scientific foundation for it.
Well, there are a lot of players in this effort to treat pain. In addition to physicians and patients, we also have Drug Enforcement Administration, Food and Drug Administration, and right now they're looking at different strategies for what they call REMS, risk evaluation and mitigation strategies, especially for opioids. Could you explain that a little bit?
Sure. In both the DEA and the FDA, and the centers had the opportunity to work with both of these federal agencies, play really important roles in our society. The DEA to make sure that that the drugs that are dispensed in this country are safe and appropriate and that they're available and not misused for non-medical purposes. FDA is there to keep our food and drug supply safe and so forth. What I think we're experiencing is that there is this tension between medicine and law about this, and ergo this talk about trying to find balance, because both of these important institutions in our society are working on important issues, important public health issues. Certainly, we have seen a dramatic increase in the abuse of prescription drugs. particularly among teenagers, which is very, very alarming. At the same time, you said in your opening remarks that there's evidence, a lot of evidence, about the gross undertreatment of pain for people who are struggling day to day, who may not be able to work, care for their families, interact interpersonally, lots and lots of problems. The challenge is trying to figure out how to support these efforts at the same time and where one does not negatively impact the other, in particular populations that are vulnerable. One of the efforts that we've spent a lot of time the last, I guess, almost exactly a year now, I believe it was February of 2009. Actually, as I think about this, it may have been February of 2008.
It seems like a long time.
It seems like it's been a long time. It was 1988, but the FDA announced that they intended to expand a program that they already had in place called REMS. REMS stands for Risk Evaluation and Mitigation Strategies. They called on the manufacturers of controlled substances, of opiates, to come together and to create a plan that would help ensure that these drugs were not inappropriately dispensed, that they were safeguarded in the distribution chain, and that patients who were receiving them, people who were receiving them, were doing so for appropriate medical reasons. Now, that, at first blush, who's going to argue against that? No one. I mean, that's a sound idea. If you think through that idea to its logical conclusion, there are some of the things that have been proposed really would have very negative consequences on those people who are experiencing chronic pain and acute pain. And if you look again at the data, we're talking a lot today about science and data and so forth. If you look at the data, the people who are abusing prescription drugs are not pain patients. We have some studies, not a lot of data, but it is believed that 2 to 5% of all people who ever receive a prescription for chronic pain do anything untoward with those medications. They need those medications, so they are not, they're highly unlikely to divert them, is the language that we would use. So over the last several months now, we'll say, the FDA has held a number of public hearings. They've sought public comment. The center has been to Washington. John Carney and I, our vice president here, have been back and forth to Washington to talk with the FDA about the fact that as they move forward, we're certainly supportive of their goal of trying to make sure that these medications, these drugs, are dispensed in a safe manner. But we also want them to be very careful as they formulate strategies not to negatively and unintendedly, I believe, harm those people who really need these medications.
Now, I understand the comment period for that has been extended through October of 2010, so people still have the opportunity to comment on that.
They can, and they can go to the Federal Register if they wish to do so. And, Laurel, maybe you'd want to put on the website where people can do that. But the reality is they have gotten an enormous amount of input. I think I have heard representatives from the FDA say that they were overwhelmed by their response to the call for public input. And actually, I think I've heard it said that they've received more response than any other event in their history.
Well, a lot of people have a lot at stake at this. Physicians, patients.
Manufacturers. I mean, there are lots of players here, certainly.
Well, one of the things, one of the goals of the center's work in this arena has been to educate the players, I guess, physicians in particular, and the legal community. Mm-hmm. And the center has been working with the American Academy of Family Physicians and other organizations on a program to train physicians in pain treatment.
Right. In fact, the project that you're referring to, Laurel, is a project of the American Academy of Family Physicians, and we think that that is exactly the right target for this educational endeavor. AAFP has about 90,000 members, so this is a large constituency, And it is primary care, the primary care provider who most often is prescribing these medications. So we have been collaborating with AAFP, and we encouraged AAFP, which they did, to involve the American Academy of Pain Medicine and also the Federation of State Medical Boards, because those are two other major players here. And we have developed a curriculum. It's a three-hour curriculum that focuses on a lot of things. I mean, to try to cover the treatment of pain in 3 hours is a challenge. But we have developed a curriculum that we're all very proud of. It has been now tested in, in two sites. We've tested it in Greensboro, North Carolina, and in Minneapolis. In the next few weeks, we will be taking it to three other cities around the country. We've also developed a webcast that will be online with AAFP. I believe in July is our goal.
How have the physicians who have attended this, how have they responded to these programs?
Well, you know, it's been really, really interesting to me, the responses. And I've seen, we've only done it in two cities at this point, but in both events, we've had people from several states at these meetings. And, you know, I say about this kind of program often, I fear that this is the choir meeting. You know, these are people who probably are prescribing. They're really trying to hone their skills, stay right up on the leading edge of their practice so that they're doing the best that they can for their patients. And I respect people, especially these programs are on Saturdays. So when people take time away from the basketball game or whatever it is that they need to do at home, well, that indicates to me a high level of interest. But my experience is that even this group of physicians, we've had large audiences on both occasions, even this group demonstrate that they have a lot of gaps in what they know. As I said, the field is evolving fairly rapidly, so that's understandable. We hear over and over again, which we all know, that they did not receive education and training when they were going through medical school or their internships or residencies or whatever about the treatment of pain. Also, still a lot of concern about regulatory oversight. As you know, I have been on the board of the Kansas Board of Healing Arts in the past. I'm no longer on that board, but I have disclosed that in these meetings because I want physicians and boards to understand and really to embrace the notion that they are working together, that they are not working at odds with one another. But there's still a lot of concern about this, and there is really a lot of tension that continues. I hope that with educational programs and with the work that the center is doing on the other side of the street, so to speak, with law enforcement to help them understand the impact of their work on the treatment of pain, that we are moving in the right direction.
The center's work in this arena will be recognized at the February 2010 annual meeting of the American Academy of Pain Medicine. What does that award mean to you and the center?
I think for physicians to recognize the center in this way is quite meaningful to me, and I hope to others here at the center. It's been interesting because, just as you know, a few months ago, the American Academy of Pain Management also gave the center an award that they call their Head and Heart Award. I think for the center to be recognized by these two groups for the work that we've done in this area indicates to me that they see our contribution is positive and helpful. Not that we want to be sweeping up awards. It's nice to be recognized, but I do want this work recognized to be important. Ethics is not the soft, fluffy stuff. Ethics is really the way I think that people make better decisions, or a way for people to make better decisions and to have more confidence that what they're doing is really, quote unquote, the right thing to do. Problems associated with it.
Myra Christopher is the president and CEO of the Center for Practical Bioethics. I'm Laurel LeBoux. Thanks for listening to the Bioethics Channel.